Welcome, everybody, to Your Hour. This is the European American Hour and also the hour that I give you my information that I've picked up from all of you from all over the world. This is a program dedicated to the interests of white folks all around the world to break through the what I like to refer to as the kosher curtain. The kosher matrix, that matrix that bewilders the normal person because it's made to sound as if it's more confusing, that world affairs are more confusing than they really are. It's very simple. It's who controls the means of communication, who controls the banking, finance, Federal Reserve type issues. Garbage in, garbage out. It's a pleasure to come to you today on November 18th, 2012. My mind is full of stuff. Full of stuff that I've been reading about, and I do have a lot of despair right now because of the election, even though I didn't vote for Romney, who I like to refer to as O. Romney. But there's an opportunity here because of the fact that there's so many people, so many white folks now that are freaking out. I was talking to a friend of mine in California, and I said, you know, there's two big The way I look at it, there's two big wake-up calls, racial wake-up calls for white America. Ann Coulter, in her book, Mugged, talks about the OJ decision. Yes, indeed, the OJ decision was a wake-up call for white America. You see, OJ, even though he was not convicted of the crime of murder, it was obvious to those of us who could see what was going on that OJ had legally, let me just back up, had officially killed two people that were not supposed to be killed. A white woman who he was married to, and forgive me if I can't remember if he was still married to her at the time that of the murder of her, but also, he had killed, her Jewish lover, her Jewish male lover, his wife or ex-wife's Jewish male lover. Ann Coulter says that was the end of white guilt. I beg to differ, Ann. I believe that was the end of white shame. There's a big difference between white guilt, like we have something to do with all the evil in the world, and white shame. Shame of our own ethnicity. I believe that a lot of white folks, and from what I observed of people around me, both conservative and liberal, that OJ killing was a day of reckoning. A day of personal inventory for a lot of white folks. How do they judge African Americans, and especially African-American celebrities, and how do they judge the media's coverage of that event, of that murderous event, literally? Now, white shame is a terrible thing. A friend of mine wised me up to that a few years ago. He said, our problem among our people is white shame, shame of their own heritage, shame of their own desires to have justice, social justice for white folks, white liberation. That the way we are being white-bashed in the media, the way in the kosher media, which is the media, except for countercurrents and websites and media like American Renaissance, Occidental Observer, yes, we here at Countercurrents are here to wake up and to remind people of ethnic reality. Jared Taylor talks about racial realism and the fact that that white folks need to be racial realists. I agree with that. So what we as white folks are losing our country. This second wake-up call, which is very obvious, which is this last election of Barack Hussein Obama. I've been reading stories like up in Maine where the head of the Maine Republican Party, I believe it was, said that all of a sudden on election day, all these black folks started showing up. He said about 100 black folks, maybe it was more, I don't know, showed up in his to vote in his district. He says, we don't have any black folks here, as I remember he said in this article. Some places there was, I don't know if that was, it was Philadelphia or what voting district, but evidently 107% of voters voted. It is a unbelievable wake-up call for white America. The 1-2 punch, the OJ verdict, where he was found innocent by the black power, predominantly black power jury, and then this Obama victory. I read something this week. I don't know if it was WorldNet Daily, it may have been another website, where it was talking about the great racial and gender divide after election day, that more and more the Republican Party is the party of white males, and that on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, in the Democratic Party, it's a party of white women and ethnic minorities, non-white ethnic minorities. Our issue, which I think is the toughest one for all of us, is the racial divide between white men and women. I remember in the 90s, I was over at the University of San Francisco, and I'm trying to, Susan Beresford. Susan Beresford was there. She was the she was the CEO of the Ford Foundation. I don't know what she's doing now. She's still connected with the Ford Foundation. But she was there giving a speech about how great the Ford Foundation was and about its impact in society. And the Ford Foundation, of course, which I've mentioned from this book, Importing Revolution, which talks about how the Ford Foundation and other foundations funded all these groups, all these Latino power groups, black power groups, feminist power groups. Susan Beresford was there, and after the event, I went over to her, and she thought I was going to shake her hand, and I said, Miss Beresford, a Jewish woman, a kosher woman, that's who she is. And again, let me back up and tell you what I told her. I said, Miss Beresford, I said, you have caused more damage between European American men and women than any other person because of your programs at the Ford Foundation. Well, as I remember, one of the executives of, or not executives, of people on the board of the Ford Foundation was a Jewish guy, I can't remember if it was Strauss, his last name was Strauss, he was there standing beside her, and he started to put his hands on me. And I said, don't you dare put your hands on me. So I made my ethnic statement about what Miss Beresford and her organization, the Ford Foundation, had done to destroy the special relationship that we used to have between men and women. Now, there was a few people around that were horrified at my political action. But guess what? I didn't give a damn. Because I let her know, and I let her wealthy kosher capitalist friend who was standing next to her what the real situation was, and that I knew who was behind this effort on their part, successful effort, to split white men and women from each other, to look at the fact that we have different interests. All you have to do is look at the divorce rate between white men and women. I talked last week about how white men and white women vote differently, and what I found out in Marin County back in the 80s when I was working there as a volunteer for the Republican Party to call people up to remind them to vote. And time again, I saw households where the husband was Republican and the woman was Democrat. And if you happen to see on the internet recently about talking about the wealthiest counties in the United States and how they voted, and the fact that Marin County, which is the county just north of San Francisco, voted for Obama, I think it was something like 74%. That's the wealthiest. That was, I don't know if it was the wealthiest county, but it was one of the wealthiest. It's one of the wealthiest counties in the United States, but it voted hands down the biggest percentage for Obama, 74%. So we've got a problem in our own community between white men and white women. I think it's very important that there be discussion about that. Why is this going on? I think it's the most difficult discussion of all among those of us who support white people, those of us in the media, our media. It's painful. But just like that friend of mine, Jody, who's since passed away from cancer, who I worked with when I was driving a bus. She had been horrified the fact that I had supported David Duke for governor of Louisiana. But when, and she thought that because the newspapers around the U.S. had printed the names of those of us who had contributed to David Duke as a way to intimidate us, she felt as if because she and I were friends, that I would sic some kind of an extremist on her. She was fearful of me because of the newspaper coverage and the hysteria around David Duke running for the interests of white folks. But after the OJ decision, like I had mentioned before, my friend Jody came up to me when I was on a break at the Transbay Terminal in San Francisco, knocked on my door, the door of my bus, and again said, "Let's talk." And I said, "Sure, Jody." And then she talked about how this stuff has got to stop, meaning the OJ type decision. See, Jody was a lesbian. And Jody was fearful because this black man had been acquitted, and the charges against him were that he had that he had killed a white woman and a Jewish man. Now in California at that time, I'm sure there was a lot of other white liberals like Jody who thought, "Oh my God, this can't be." Now Jody started fearing for those blacks that she saw on TV that were cheering. And in fact, in our driver's room, she watched the blacks in the courtroom and the black jurors applauding and cheering and doing the black power salute in the courtroom. See, all of a sudden then, her attitude changed. All of a sudden, she was fearing that liberal coalition that she was in. You know, the one. White women, black men and women, Latinos, Asians, American Indians, Jewish people, Arabs, you know, that the great phalanx of the left, of the liberal coalition. So I'm going to stop right there, and then I'll continue with the second portion of your hour here on the Countercurrents Network in just a few minutes. Hey, folks, I'm back again, and this is the second portion of your hour. And this is November 18th, 2012, and talking about this issue of the great divide within the white community between white men and white women, and how we just vote different, don't we? I mentioned last week that I had finished this book called Back to Blood, and I urge everyone who's interested in ethnic literature to actually read this book. It's written by Tom Wolfe, W-O-L-F-E, and it's an incredible book about how the different ethnicities are at each other's throats, and that the Cubanos, the Cubans, are now the white power structure of Miami. And as a guy I used to work with who was Puerto Rican said, back in the 90s when he had a, he flew back to Miami to visit with his, Puerto Rican relatives. I think his sister was living back there then. The cab driver told him, he says, if you don't speak Spanish here in Miami, you can't make it. Well, again, that's all because of the immigration laws. And we know, Ted Kennedy and Jacob Javits, the two spearheads of that legislation, of one of many spearheads that changed the demographics of this country. But it's what it is, folks. We're going to have to deal with this and deal with this Republican Party, which consistently stabs us in the back. Now, I don't know about you, but practicality rules for me. Locally up here in Idaho, I vote for most Republicans when it comes to local politics. I did not vote for Raul Labrador, the Republican nominee who won again his second term, who used to be an immigration attorney helping Latinos. I just wrote myself in, like I mentioned last week. But I think it's extremely important for us to come up with some strategies. Maybe part of the strategy is like what my friend Sam says down in Florida, which is let the bad times roll. But also we need to start talking among ourselves, writing among ourselves, writing in our own media, talking in our own media about how are we going to bring white women, men and women together. I think it's very important to talk about what is dividing us. Now, I can tell you up here, there's a woman who is an acquaintance of mine who is a liberal Democrat, and she works in the medical field, and she was talking to me and some other people recently about the fear she had because she almost was lost her job. She was almost let go. This medical company corporation that she works for, let go a lot of people. She was very close to being let go. She's 60 years old now. She just bought a house up here. So even though that she feels good in the sense that her candidate won, same time as she told me and some other people, she may be the next one. She may be part of the next group of people who is let go. Now, this woman is extremely competent in what she does. She's very ethical. But again, when we have our brothers and sisters out of work, they're going to start questioning a lot of things. And I know for myself, my job is to focus on what's the cause of this. Another woman I know who's in her mid-50s, and I think I've mentioned her before, she also just got a job after being laid off for 6 months. She was also in the medical field. Now, I know some of you have followed the fact that after the election, a number of companies have said they're laying off people. Hostess Twinkies, our Hostess baking company, closed down completely when the union guys went on strike. You know, these companies that are closing down because of they don't want to deal with Obamacare. And I heard this recently on the radio, that what's going on is that companies are changing the status of employees from full-time to part-time so that they don't have to pay the costs of Obamacare. So, more economic insecurity. Anyway, let me get back to this this thing about this book, Back to Blood. In Miami, this novel is set in Miami, and what I found interesting is the bad guy is a Russian. There is a number of bad guys in this book, and the extreme bad guy is a Russian. And I see this kind of stuff going on over and over again, whether it be writers of novels or films, sitcoms. We got the bad guys, which are the Southerners, the white Southerners. You got the Russians. And that seems to be the model for who is the bad person, the bad guy. But anyway, lot of things that are on my mind here. I have a friend over in London, and I've mentioned him before. And we send each other articles, and he was talking to me about the white capitalist class and how they've turned their back on us. Regular white folks. And I agree. I got a friend of mine that lives in Texas, and he's still working, doing well economically. And I was talking about the state of the nation in terms of the racial tension and the fact that whites are losing more and more. And he says, well, you know, here in Texas, we have a good economy. And I started thinking about, yeah, it's because of the oil, but it's also because of the fact that George Bush, when he was governor, was very Latino friendly and never talked about strong enforcement of the border. Another friend of mine in Texas told me talking about Harris County where Houston is, and the fact that all of these minority voters participated and that whites are a minority in Harris County. So what may be a good economic environment right now may turn out to be a lot worse as the non-white population increases. I was watching this thing on C-SPAN just by accident. I was just channel surfing, and there was this thing on C-SPAN. In fact, you can watch it if you go to cspanvideo.org, and you type in Texas Tribune Festival, September 22nd, 2012. And it was a discussion between Henry Cuellar, who's, as I remember, his father was a congressman down there in South Texas before him. His father since passed away. Henry Cuellar's senior was one of the people pushing the 1965 immigration bill, Ted Kennedy and Jacob Javits and all the rest of those crooks. But anyway, his son was in this discussion moderated by this guy that looked Latino to me. But anyway, he... I'm just trying to read this thing. The title was, How Safe is the Border? And this man named Todd Staples, who is now the Texas Agricultural Commissioner, who's a Republican, who's going to be running for Lieutenant Governor in 2014, has been trying to get the Obama administration to secure the Texas border from the drug cartels. Well, Congressman Cuellar, Henry Cuellar, was playing with him, literally playing with him, about the fact that Cuellar said, well, he says, you know, I don't like this talk about the border being a war zone. And you could see that, and he said it with a smile, and he said, and with this mock concern, he knows that border is wide open. Staples was talking about there's not enough, border patrol guys or ICE patrol people down at the border. And Cuellar was talking about, well, you know, he said, you know, when Bush was in office, they couldn't find the money for it. They wouldn't fund the border patrol. And I thought to myself, yeah, Bush didn't want to fund the Border Patrol, George Bush, when he was governor of Texas, because of the fact that he wanted that cheap labor for his white capitalist friends. But you see, Staples, Todd Staples, even though he looks like a guy that really would like to do something about the border, but as soon as Cuellar, who's Mexican-American, starts talking about the fact that he has problems with looking at the border as a war zone and that it's not a black and white issue. And of course it's a war zone. Mexico is a narco-terrorist state. We don't need the border patrol on the border. We need the United States military that's over in Asia or in Europe to come home and set up right on the border. And not just to keep the illegal aliens out. We've got these people going back and forth across the border, whether it's through San Diego or through Arizona, New Mexico, Texas. And why are we letting these people come through as just as if there's no problem. We know the Latino leadership is talking about La Raza and Aslan, and they're going to take back the Southwest U.S. But we have a white guy named Todd Staples who is definitely a good guy, but he can't even talk with the same strength as Cuellar because he doesn't want to sound racist, according to how the kosher media and our kosher government would view a white person wanting to protect sovereignty. So again, it is, I tell you folks, I was so angry watching this program. I know my blood pressure was spiked. I was shouting at this guy on the screen, this Cuellar. It made me so mad. So that's why I do this program, folks, is because I think it is so important for all of us to share information and to create a network, an information network, so that when things really fall apart, we will be there to encourage white folks in the U.S. and white folks around the world to resist their kosher oppressors. I'm about halfway through a book now. It's called Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by an African-American writer named Manning Marable, who has since passed away. But reading Malcolm X, about Malcolm X, and I had originally read the autobiography of Malcolm X that was written in conjunction with Alex Haley. In fact, back in the 70s, my father even read this book about the autobiography of Malcolm X. What's good about this book is that it's a restating of what Malcolm and the black Muslims had said and done in the past, but also new information that had been covered up about Malcolm X. Malcolm X and his white Armenian girlfriend. Oh, you didn't know about that, did you, folks? The man that talked about the blue-eyed white devils. Yes, indeed. He had a white Armenian girlfriend. And by the way, also, what also has come out in this book, according to Manning Marable's research by talking to black Muslims, both black Muslims that were part of the family of Malcolm X, but others, that evidently, according to this book, Malcolm X had a white boyfriend who was a rich guy up in New England. So isn't it interesting when we find out the real story, the real information? Now, this book in 2000, this came out in 2011, this book was called one of the 10 best books by the New York Times Book Review, San Francisco Chronicle, An Extraordinary Portrait of a Man in His Time, a Masterpiece. Ebony Magazine, this book is a must read. The Washington Post, it will be difficult for anyone to better this book. It goes deeper and richer than a mere homage. Having trouble with that word today, folks, to Malcolm X. It is a work of art, a feast that combines genres skillfully, biography, true crime, political commentary. It gives us Malcolm X in full gallop, a man who died for his belief in freedom. Well, what's interesting is what Malcolm, for me, besides this information, is the way that Malcolm talked to black folks. And I will continue with that information and more in the third portion of the hour. And I'm going to take another break. Okay, back to the Your Hour, the European American Hour. And as I was mentioning towards the end of the second portion about this new book called Malcolm X, actually came out, what was it, 2011, I think. But anyway, this book came out right before the author died. So, yeah, 2011. But Malcolm X, as I was mentioning earlier, Malcolm X talked straight to the black community. And one of the things I liked was he talked about the Democratic Party being the fox and the Republican Party being the wolf. And he said, the fox, the Democratic Party, will smile as it's eating you. Now, that's a paraphrase. Now, it's just the opposite for white folks. For us whites, the fox is the Republican Party. And, of course, we got Fox News, don't we? And, of course, that fox is eating us alive. Let me just say it, explain it to you that way. They're eating us alive slowly. Giving us candidates that talk about stuff like the fiscal cliff and foreign policy, which we know is kosher policy. And we know that for us as white folks, the Democratic Party is the wolf party. They don't hide anything. But again, it's very important to read what the other side has done and their evolution as a people. Of course, the Jewish establishment was supporting all of the non-white movements and supporting the white feminist movement that was led by Jewish women. But to see how the black radicals, like the Black Panther Party, but especially Malcolm X, let his own people know that the problem within his own community was the black bourgeoisie. Now, in our community, it's the white bourgeoisie, isn't it? Especially those arrogant whites who are in academia for the most part, who teach the students about how evil white people are and how important it is to support other ethnic groups and to support the white woman, of course, they don't say it this way, but at the expense of white men. So, again, if we're not racial realists, like Jared Taylor talks about, if we're not realists about the Jewish evolutionary strategy, which Kevin McDonald talks about, if we are not cultural critics of Hollywood, TV programs, we are not dealing with the reality of what is going on inside the normal white person, whether they're liberal or conservative. What goes in? Garbage goes in, garbage goes out. You sit in front of that television without a discerning critical mind of why are they projecting these anti-white stereotypes, these Archie Bunker type stereotypes that demean European American men and women. If we cannot reach our people to the point where our people stop watching these shows, when they become so disgusted with these representations of supposed white people on TV. I was telling a friend of mine the other day, I said, you know, when I look at these people with these blow-dried hairdos and perfect clothing attires, but also when I see these whites that are demonized, these white working class people, especially from the South, who when they bend over, you can see their ass and their belly hanging over their belt and they're missing teeth. And this is presented as a program. There's one on now called Duck Dynasty. That is the most insulting thing to Southern white men I've ever seen in my life. I see this other program on TV now called Breaking Amish. How about a show called Breaking Kosher? Breaking Jewish. Again, horrible stereotypes. Michael Hoffman wrote a booklet about the defamation of whites in Hollywood quite a number of years ago. The American Renaissance and Occidental Observer start to zero in on this. The popular media, the popular kosher media, as we well know. I believe that the great awakening in terms of ethnic consciousness will occur when white males en masse stop going to the National Football League games, to the National Basketball Association games. If we ever have a racial incident that will electrify whites, like the OJ decision, or like Barack Obama's second term, then the media will have to cover it. So again, a white boycott of professional sports. Now, if I was up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I'd be, every once in a while, I would go to the Minneapolis or to the Minnesota Timberwolves game. White? Why? Because they have more white players than on any other They have more white players on their team than any other NBA team. I see nothing wrong with every once in a while whites going to a basketball game, let's say a professional basketball game, where there's a great white shooter like a Pistol Pete Maravich who played at LSU and then eventually went and played for the Celtics, and I think he played for the New Orleans professional basketball team too. But anyway, there's nothing wrong with going to a game and rooting for a white brother. Or in the WBNA or whatever it's called, the Women's National Basketball Association, to rooting for a white woman who is a great basketball player. Folks, the Jewish people talk about whatever's good for Jews. We need, and I live my life looking at the idea and lasering on the idea of it's all about whites and whatever is good for whites. I'm sure a lot of you have been hit by this economic depression that we're all going through. I think it's extremely important, folks, that you may not call it a tithe, but to donate to Countercurrents. Donate to this network that is bringing you this information that you won't find on the Manhattan Borough networks. I also subscribe to the Nationalist Times. Because the Nationalist Times talks about our issues. And on the internet, they are anunews.net. Or www.anu.org. You can purchase a subscription by contacting them. I want to point out something which is extremely important, folks. And I mentioned this last week. But what has happened at Countercurrents is the totals are out, folks. And we're getting a increase in the number of people that are going over to our network, to our site. The column for unique visitors, I think I mentioned this last week, 81,739 last month, October 2012. Number of hits, 416,362. That means people are starting to come over here, folks, because they're tired of following the kosher media. I'm also looking at the which shows had the biggest viewership or listenership. And I see Greg Johnson's interview of Matthew Heimbach on October 8th of this year received 4,039 people listening to that show. Now, as you know, I talked about Matthew before. Greg has interviewed him. Matthew is head of the White Student Union back east at Towson University in Maryland. We've got to reach the youth, folks. I see Keith Preston's show on October 15th, Political Predictions. 3,130 listeners. Paul Fromm interviewing Lady Michelle Renouf on October 12th, 2,660 listeners. Robert Stark interviewing Ciriaco Acta, 2,656. And then I see the show I did of October 21st, 2012, the White Student Union and Politically Correct Hate Speech, 2,488 people tuned into that. So what I can tell you, folks, is the fact that Greg Johnson's interview with Matthew Heimbach of the White Student Union of Towson University in Maryland, and then my show on the White Student Union, which came in fifth in terms of listenership, that means there are some young people that are wanting to know about the idea, the concept, the reality of the White Student Union. We have got to reach young people, young white people in the universities. Malcolm X in this, in his book talked about how he was a prisoner himself, but he used to focus on black men in the prisons. As things get bad in this country and more people find, become at the, end up at the wrong end of political, ethnic, economic persecution, more of our people, men and women, are going to end up in jails and prisons because of their frustration with the system which oppresses them. So at some point in time, it's obvious that white activists are going to have to really focus on that, on these people who have been incarcerated, who come out onto the streets and have no hope. And by the way, folks, I found out a long time ago in San Francisco that why there's so many white homeless living out on the streets in these big cities is because they don't dare stay the night in these homeless shelters because of the blacks and browns who will rob them, beat them up. So we're going to have to be involved in helping the less fortunate, social work. The other ethnic groups do it. Our churches are going to have to start getting involved, not just with the spiritual part of it, but the ethnic thing to helping whites. Actually, they're doing this now. But we need more of an emphasis on the fact that more and more white people are affected by this economic downturn. Now here on this email I got from Greg Johnson, it talks about the countries with people who listen to the show and what countries they're from. Look at this top 20, folks. U.S., Great Britain, Canada, Germany, Australia, Sweden, France, Brazil, the Netherlands, Spain, India, Poland, Ireland, Norway, Czech Republic, Italy, Greece, Finland, Portugal, Denmark. That's where our listenership is, folks. Kosher political correctness has forced us to look at ourselves as a people, thank God. So God bless all of you who are listening to this program, not just from the United States, but around the world. You are our brothers and sisters. So folks, those of you who live in the United States, have a very happy Thanksgiving, a very sane Thanksgiving. Keep your eyes open. Listen. Find out what people are saying. Ask people what they think about what's happening to whites, especially after this election. But let's try to figure this out, and let's work together for a solution to our survival, which is working together as brothers and sisters. So this is the end of the program today, folks. Thank you for listening, and continue to listen to other programs on the Countercurrents Network. Thank you.